Grosso from Vancouver to win it for Canada! Canada came! Canada conquered! Canada gold!
Buchanan with the cross in towards Alphonso Davies! Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar! A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades! Finally arrives!
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo, Alexander Gonge-Rujic, and your host, Ben Steiner.
Welcome back to the Northern Football Podcast. Canada is going back to the Olympics. This is episode 141 of NFB. Ben Steiner alongside Alex Gonge-Rujic and Peter Galindo. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on social as well. And I already alluded to it, but Canada is heading back to the Olympic Games. They're heading to Paris 2024 with a 2-1 win over Jamaica at BMO Field on Tuesday night. A beautiful sellout on a beautiful night at BMO Field, warmer than it has been for fall matches in the past, at least on the men's side. Goals from Chloe Lacasse and Jordan Heidema powering Canada after a fantastic free kick from Drew Spence to open the scoring for Jamaica for a few tense moments at BMO Field. Canada winning 4-1 on aggregate after a 2-0 win in Kingston, Jamaica on Friday. Tactical changes, fresh faces. There was a lot of changes in these two legs, and I think we can all agree that Canada's a little bit refreshed with this women's national team. Just your initial reactions on qualifying for the Olympics yet?
Yeah, I think the panic alert can be turned off and we can change that to cautious optimism again, sort of what we were maybe thinking leading into the World Cup, even amidst the issues we saw at the She Believes Cup and the labor dispute and the lack of resources, etc. But even still, you looked at the quality of the squad and you thought, yeah, they could still probably do a bit of damage to the World Cup. We all know how it turned out. And the fact that these were two essentially do-or-die games to get to the Olympics, and the last time they were in a high-pressure situation, they wilted, to go out there in both games, in also a sticky situation where you concede out of nowhere off a free kick, and you're 1-0 down, all of a sudden Jamaica's within a goal of pulling level on aggregate, and not only do you turn it around and get pretty much an instant response, you kind of blow the doors off them. And so that's why, as I'm sure we're going to get into at length in this section, you can go into it saying, you know what, there's a lot to like, and I'm very curious now to see what kind of happens to close out the year, because now there are a lot of intriguing questions surrounding the team.
Yeah, pressure makes diamonds, and that certainly was the case for, you know, Bev Priestman and her staff, this team, because look, at the World Cup, of course, there's pressure. It is a World Cup. It is a marquee tournament, but almost Canada didn't really play like there was all that much pressure. Actually, well, they did play like the pressure. They succumbed to it. And part of the reason was that they kind of went into the World Cup. They didn't really evolve, right? We kind of mentioned it after the tournament, like they were kind of stuck in certain tactical ways, kind of stuck in certain players that maybe were struggling. And to give credit to Priestman, she was under real pressure heading into this because, okay, you screw up a World Cup. While it sucks, it also happens, right? It's a three-game tournament. It's something where Canada, after two games, they weren't in the worst position in the world. They had 4 points, and then they just completely fell apart in the last game. So it was really that one last game that killed them. Well, you can't go then follow it up and then miss an Olympics, especially given you'd medaled at three straight, you've been to four straight. Like, you can't miss out on this tournament. So that was real pressure for Priestman, especially this Jamaican side. There weren't any pushovers, and they showed it across two legs, right? Like, even in heading into the second leg, that Drew Spence free kick, that was just, I mean, technically, you're not getting many better free kick goals than that. And imagine if they had Bunny Shaw in their lineup, they could have even really made a game of it if she wasn't injured. So this was a good Jamaican team. But for Canada, what I love about their performance was that they had their backs against the wall. Priestman especially, like, you even heard some rumblings like, okay, if they don't make it through to the Olympics, like, could her job be on the line? Absolutely. And she goes out and she takes risks that maybe she didn't even take at the World Cup. She switches her formation completely. She slots Jade Rose right in, like, fresh out of off of an injury, straight, you know, still in college, slot her in. Sydney Collins, you know, maybe have a dozen pro games under your belt, fresh out of college. All right, you can start some big games too. You know, dropping Jordan Heidema and Evelyn Vian, your main number nine options. Nichelle Prince, you're back from injury, go back to the number nine. And a few of those bold decisions, dropping Julia Grosso, again, something where on paper, it's hard to imagine a best 11 where Julia Grosso isn't in it. But Priestman's like, all right, well, Grosso, you didn't really fit in at the World Cup. You're not fitting in this three 4-2-1. Let's switch it up. And those decisions ended up paying off. So I think it was a credit to Priestman for those changes. And then also a credit to those who stepped up, like Collins. I was going to be very curious to see how she coped and with the pressure. And she did very well, home and away, two tough crowds, and looked the part. Jade Rose, really stood out, and, you know, maybe struggled a bit in the second game, but really showed why her potential and her ceiling is so high. And those are just among the many that stood out across this two-game window.
I think it was overall a big breath of fresh air for the Canadian program, because they come into this with Bev Priestman knowing that she had to make changes after the World Cup, knowing that her job was potentially in jeopardy should Canada not qualify against what is a good Jamaica team. It's still a good Jamaica team. And their head coach reminded us after the match that the last time these two teams played in Olympic qualifying was 9-0 for Canada. So a lot of growth from this Jamaican side. They certainly could have beaten Canada if Canada had come out sort of soulless like they did at the World Cup and throughout, you know, the last 14 months or so. But you come in, you make those changes. Priestman was bold. She was brave in making those adjustments. And I think that also reinvigorated the group, because even, you know, speaking with them ahead of the second leg, they were all excited to play in this new formation. They hadn't tried it out before, but it was like there was sort of just this new air around the team. And it wasn't just, you know, we're trotting out our old strategies. We know they didn't work, but we're trying again and just going through the motions, which it felt like at the World Cup. But this time it felt like something new, something energized. And I mean, you can look at the new and younger players as well, like Sydney Collins stepping right into that. You mentioned that. Even Olivia Smith thriving at the end of the match last night. Simi Owusu getting a chance as well. But we'll get into the question from WSoccerCA. What are y'all thinking about the tactical changes from this window?
We had been calling for what has felt like a year, if not more, for some form of a center back three in a 3-5-2, 3-4-3, what have you, attacking wise, and for a variety of reasons. It perhaps masks one of their bigger weaknesses, which is, apart from Kadisha Buchanan, a lack of really explosive pace at center back, especially against the top teams, where a lot of teams now just are lightning quick, especially in those transitional moments, as we saw against Australia. So that's one reason to use it. But second, you free up all the midfielders to be able to add a little bit more in the final third without maybe needing to worry too much. The wingbacks are liberated. You can get a free-flowing center forward combination, whether it's through a 1-1 split, have one player drop in between the lines, and then the other player sort of keeps that last center back honest, and then you find space that way. And all of that came to fruition in the system. And I think that's what really was relieving to see if you are Canadian, in that the open play attack actually looked far more free and loose and open, and they were actually incisive. Whereas outside of the second half against Ireland at the World Cup, you didn't really see that for a prolonged period. I mean, Ashley Lawrence was absolutely unbelievable last night. She was great in the first leg too, but last night really solidified in terms of she was probably the player of the window for Canada. And she wasn't the only one who really stood out yesterday or in the first leg either, because Lacasse and Grosso, even as a substitute in the first leg, looked really good and seemed to be freed up by the new system. Prince, Leon, Collins, they were all solid in the first leg as well, especially Leon. She looked up really lively in the first leg. But now it's really going to be fascinating to see what happens going forward here, because part of the reason perhaps Priestman changed it was because of the injuries to Jade Riviere and maybe not having certain options like Janine Becky and whatnot, and even just trying something new as well, because you saw the 4-3-3 was probably a bit stale. But utilizing that center back three now, it just gives you so many more options. And as I kind of said, in terms of the 1-1 splits and the number eights maybe having a little bit more freedom, the game is about trying to unlock an open space to get the ball through. And they were doing that at length last night. They were doing that at length in the first leg, but certainly yesterday, once I think they were able to get that equalizer and just really seemed to be freed up. And those were two of the better attacking displays they put on in a while. So it'll be fascinating to see what they can do going forward. Some will say, well, it's only Jamaica, but they played against Nigeria and looked toothless. And look, Nigeria and Jamaica aren't bad sides either. Are they the absolute elite of the elite? No, but they're solid defensive sides. And the fact that they're able to really have their way with them, 30 combined shots, I think it was 16 on target, and they produced two of their higher XG individual games since November, when at that time we were kind of finishing the calendar year and saying, well, we have a lot to look forward to in 2023. We know what happened, but now you can kind of look at this and say, yeah, it's actually looking really, really impressive again all of a sudden.
Yeah, the back three is a huge shift for me just because, well, I've been wanting to see it for a while. And the main reason was more on the build-up side, just because when building up in a four, Canada had just got too predictable. Like, especially Lawrence and Revere were getting pinned back all the time at the World Cup. You know, teams were starting to press them in like a 4-4-2, and that would just completely eliminate all of the Canada's back six options in the, because Canada's kind of playing the 4-2-3-1, and that entire back six was, it was easy to mark them in a 4-4-2. So I was very impressed to see that, again, the numerical superiority they were able to get in that three. In the first leg, for example, the way that Buchanan and Jade Rose were able to stretch alongside Gilles and then have Lawrence and Collins push up, like, Jamaica's press was in disarray because it opened up so many nice triangles in the pocket for Fleming and Quinn to drop into, and then they get it to Fleming, and then Lawrence would just immediately go into the space, and it was like the triangles were there, and I think that's the big asset in the build-up play. And then you add in as well that again, I think the key is the wing backs. I think, as you know, Ashley Lawrence, she might be the best player on this team. Like, she very well might be. If not, she's certainly up there. Playing this wing back role allows her to still do her defensive job, because I think, again, the nice thing is about having her at fullback, say, is that she's an incredible 1v1 defender. But as we've seen, she's also an incredible, you know, crosser of the ball. And the fact that she was finally able to get forward as a wingback, gets two assists in two games, it kind of speaks for itself, really. And she almost scored, a goal of the year candidate when she had that hit from 30 yards right before the Lacasse goal. Like, this is why you want Lawrence higher up the field. So the wingbacks is key, especially because you can imagine when everyone's healthy, Janine Becky could look pretty darn good on that left wing back role alongside of Lawrence on the right, who, honestly, you'd probably want to keep Lawrence on the right given some of the service she was providing. You could throw Jade Revere, Carl Collins. Like, there's going to be options at that left position. But then it kind of also comes back to one of the keys of this back three, and I think it was shown, because one of the worries was, okay, if you're playing a three, you could be a bit exposed, especially in transition. Well, I think that's where Jade Rose was so key, because, my goodness, she cleaned up a lot of messes at the back with her speed, because, Peter, you mentioned a lack of speed at the back. I mean, of course, in the second leg, some of it was Rose, who kind of inflicted it on herself. She made a few turnovers, and that's why she came off at half. But having a weapon like that, where in a few transition moments, right, I thought Canada was cooked. I thought they were done. Rose made, had some incredible recoveries. Buchanan had some great recoveries. Gilles, like, I think that's a back three you can build around. And I mean, they're all pretty young. I mean, Rose, of course, is very young. Gilles and Buchanan, that's still a duo that should be around for, the World Cup in 27. Like, I think that's probably the most exciting part about that back three, because look, Canada, they have options in the attack. Like, the fact that it was Leon, Prince, Lacasse, this camp, you can imagine Becky slotting it up front when healthy, Deanne Rose when healthy, Jordan Hoytema as well, Evelyn Vian. Like, I don't think the attack will be an option. It was always more the service, the supply, and the fact they were able to solve that shows that they score four goals, three of them from open play. That was much missed over the World Cup.
And from Blair Donnelly at Medic 1849, Sydney Collins impressed me. In 180 minutes, she looked composed defensively and a threat offensively. Do you see her cracking the Olympic squad? If so, at which player's expense? Side note, she was very humble and gracious, signing autographs with the fans at the end of the match. Certainly started to build a bit of a career for herself with the national team. I think we'll be seeing her again, certainly given the chance to crack the Olympic roster, and given the way that she performed and playing 180 minutes, starting both games, you'd think that she would make the Olympic roster. But then again, the Olympic roster is 18 players. It's tough to crack, and it's going to be a difficult one for this Canadian team. And there's some players that, seem certainties not to make it. Like, dare I say, Christine Sinclair is not going to go to the Olympics, I don't think. Priest Ming sort of alluded to that yesterday, that those conversations kind of have to be had. And I think we all agree that they do. Like, she looked better, but not good, not in the best 18, I don't think.
Especially when you're going to be going up against elite opposition.
Exactly. You need the top players. And so Sydney Collins, I'd like to see crack the roster, but I think it also sort of depends on her form in the NWSL or wherever she's playing at that point.
And she has, what, 9-10 months basically to lock down that spot. There are going to be plenty more games left. Based on what you saw in the two legs, obviously she's going to get a lot of goodwill now, understandably so, because what was one of the big things that we were looking at when Jade Riviere got hurt was, okay, can her two-way ability be adequately replaced? And it was. And that is a massive relief because now you know that you have someone who can pretty much just be a plug-and-play option if Riviere can't go, or if you want to give her a rest, you can throw in someone in there who's going to fit into this system. Both of them will fit into the system easily. So clearly she's going to have a leg up in that regard, but the big question is at whose expense. You have to say it would, you would have to start looking at the players who, as we always do when it comes to the Olympics, who can't really play multiple roles and or who isn't as much of a key player as others. And from there, it becomes a really interesting question here, because if you're only going to go with essentially two out and out midfielders, do you end up looking at dropping someone from there to accommodate an extra wing back slash center back option? And that's going to be the burning question here. But yeah, I'll be fascinated to see what Collins can do in the coming games. Because as we know, the Federation is going to make a massive effort to schedule games in every single window from here on out for the rest of the year. So she's going to have opportunities to play in a Canadian shirt and build on what she did in this window.
Yeah, the Olympics is going to be fascinating. I'm curious to see if they keep the 18. I genuinely do, because I feel like there's going to be strong pushback from the federations, especially now with all the, especially next summer, because next summer it's important to remember Canada could be playing in two tournaments. Well, they will be playing in two tournaments because the Gold Cup and the Olympics are back to back. Like that could be some absurd fixture congestion, because the Gold Cup's going to be a great test for the Olympics because there's the CONMEBOL teams there. Of course, you're going to have the U.S. I think it's something where Canada will want to go for and almost use it as like an Olympics audition, right? Like you go, you do well at the Gold Cup, and then you work your way in. I'd be surprised if it's still 18 because that just feels outdated. Like there's no world where you need, we're only having 16 outfielders is makes sense with all the demands of modern football, how demanding the schedule is. But for sure, there's going to be some tough discussions, even to make a 23 going now, going forward. And Collins, especially, it opens up such an interesting debate at fullback because I think on the right side, I mean, Lawrence is the lock. And I think you can argue even, Jade Riviere, when healthy, is also going to be a lock. But what do you do after that? Because, Gabby Carl also looked good in the first leg. And she's just continuing to perform at the NWSL level. She just really hasn't gotten a chance to show for it with Canada. Collins immediately looks like a modern fullback. Like she's got the speed. She can drive forward. She just wants to take players on, which is impressive. Because this is someone who's more of a center back, shifted out to a fullback this year as a pro and, with Canada. So she has that. She's left-footed too, which is an asset because sometimes that is the, two righties has hurt Canada with Lawrence and Riviera at wingback. So for Collins, that also with Collins and Carl, what does this Chapman is what happens to Alicia Chapman, who missed out on this camp for personal reasons, because you're going to get from Chapman defensively, but sometimes going forward, she might not provide as much as you'll need, especially in a back three where you're going to want your wing backs to push forward. Of course, Chapman's been playing at center back for the Dash and she's tried that role for Canada, but she might not end up being one of the number one or number two choices at wing back if Collins and Carl build off this. So yeah, there's going to be some really intriguing questions at that fullback position, I think, with Collins' emergence, because there's also a few other players that are stepping up who we could be chatting about over the next few windows.
And from fake name Vaughn Anonymous, why didn't Quinn play? It was down to injury. Apparently they tested it out in warmups. They were initially in the starting lineup, but it just didn't feel right, so they swapped in. They swapped out for Julia Grosso, and I thought Grosso did fine in the role. I thought that she borderline thrived. It definitely took a little bit of time for her to get used to the new formation and gameplay.
And in a slightly altered role. I think once she was given the liberties to get forward, I think that's when she started to really excel. And it's good that you at least have that option to, if Quinn is hurt, then you can replace them with Giulio Grosso, someone like that, right, of that quality. It's a good problem to have. Hopefully the injury isn't too serious, which it doesn't seem to be. Clearly, Canada wanted to be precautious. Priestman wanted to tread with caution in that regard because Quinn only just returned from an injury too, so that could have exacerbated it further.
Yeah, I mean, Quinn was missed. I mean, they just, he saw it in the first leg. I thought they were kind of just quietly solid. Like, there was a lot of praises sung about the new formation, Collins, Lawrence, et cetera, in leg one. And I thought Quinn was, for my money, one of the best players on the pitch. And yeah, I'm going to be curious to see what happens with Grosso long term, because if Quinn and Fleming are the options, does Canada try like a 3-1-4-2 where like it's, you know, Quinn underneath Grosso and Fleming, but then you sacrifice a forward? Does Grosso, maybe could you consider playing Grosso as like a winger? Because we see at Juventus, like, she plays so aggressive as an eight that, you know, she plays in that half space. Maybe as a winger, she can kind of have a bit of a free role to play in that half space. Because, yeah, it's an interesting one. Because, again, you'd feel like Grosso should start. She's so dominant in Serie A with Juventus. But for the, you know, this year with Canada, she struggled to kind of find her role. And part of that's the formation not really suiting her. But you'd like to get her on the pitch because she's dangerous. And, you know, if there's a way to start her as a winger, I'd be curious to see if Priestman ends up trying something like that. Because that free role that Lacasse or Leon had as wingers, where they're just everywhere, left, right, center, crossing in the ball, dropping deep. Someone like Grosso could play it, but it might be a bit of a different tactical shift for her, given that she's used to playing as more of that advanced eight.
Yeah, I think that that number eight role is critical in this new setup, because you need that person to grab the ball and really make that move in the midfield transition. And Grosso is great at getting forward, but she's not as good as Quinn at sort of gathering the ball in the defensive third and then moving it up the pitch. And so, yeah, if you put her at the wing, maybe you create space for her on the pitch. But then again, are you running into a scenario where, yes, you have friendlies to prepare and try things out like this, but they're also friendlies that you want to get your system down. It's still a fairly new system. And so you don't necessarily want to be taking so many chances. And if you're trying to find a place for Giulio Grosso just to get on the pitch, even in an unfamiliar position, then maybe you're wasting your chances in friendlies. But that's just me.
Well, again, it's something you'll have to try out, because, I mean, yeah, do you continue to try to player in that pivot one? Again, it doesn't feel like Fleming and her, they've shown glimpses in the pivot, but it's I think you lose something defensively without Quinn, just because Quinn's the best defensive option of the three. Just they offer you so much. And yeah, I think for Grosso, I mean, if her role ends up being super sub, that's not the worst thing in the world, especially she can fill in for injuries, et cetera. She can help rotate. But I don't know, it just feels like there's more there for Grosso, but it's like hard to put a finger on what to do. Like, because she's a great player, and it's like, do we evolve your system for her when Quinn, obviously, I mean, Quinn's going nowhere, Fleming's going nowhere, I don't think, in the lineup when healthy. So it's like, do you evolve your system for her and put Grosso in as a third midfielder? Do you move Grosso in a new position? Do you try Grosso as a left-footed wing back? Like, there's so many options you could try out. And I'm curious to see how Priestman handles Grosso, because, again, I mean, there's definitely going to be depth, I think, especially when everyone's healthy. Like, when Janine Becky's healthy, Deanne Rose, like, there's going to be some good players on the bench, and Grosso may as well be one of them. That's a nice luxury to have as a national team. But also, I don't know, I'd like to think that Grosso could have a bit more of a role as a difference maker, as a starter. But that's also where I'm saying, like, if this formation sticks, having her be a super sub's not a bad thing.
And from Robert Zalinschuk, are two wins against number 37 Jamaica a get-out-of-jail card for Bev Priestman? Have your choices leading up to the World Cup as the main reason for the early potential exit?
I would say yes, if this formation and system remains, because it's clearly unlocked something for Canada's attack in open play, right? I mean, everyone, as I said, looks completely freed up by it. They look reinvigorated. The best players like Fleming and Lawrence are contributing in the final third in open play with regularity again. And it also masks some of Canada's weaknesses, as I touched on. So if this continues and the team's attack seems consistently effective, then I think we let bygones be bygones when it comes to the World Cup. Will it be perfect in every game? No, that's just the way it goes. But the fact that this situation could have gone horribly wrong with the pressure, with the fact that the World Cup was so disastrous. People were super low on what could have come, just given that Jamaica was riding high as well and they got additional funding. The fact that they went out there, got it done, scored four goals, and looked pretty dominant in both games is a massive turnaround. And I've always been a proponent of, look, coaches are going to make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes in their job, right? What matters is, do you learn from it, adapt, and improve? And clearly, at least for now, provided she sticks with us, that is exactly what Priestman has done and the coaching staff have done. And you got to give them kudos for that, because they could have just stuck with the same thing and driven this into the ground, grinded out a 0-0 in Kingston, then maybe try to sneak a set piece goal at home and just get to the Olympics and kind of get out of it unscathed. But to their credit, they were able to come up with something different and looked really good doing it.
Well, for Priestman, it's only going to happen if she didn't evolve, adjust. Because yes, look, if you look at the way her cycle has gone so far, she comes in 2021. She has a veteran heavy squad, and she could have easily just, you know, new coach, Olympics, you know, screw it, clear things out, put in new players, go to the Olympics, learn. But she doubled down on her veterans and it paid off. She pushed the right buttons. She got the right choices. She inserted the right, you know, youth, right players into the position, nailed it, won the Olympics. Right. But then you go to the World Cup. The problem is she didn't really evolve from that. Like, she kind of stuck with a lot of the same things that worked at the World, at the Olympics. They don't work at the World Cup. So for her, she had to evolve again. And I think the fact that so far she comes out, new formation, new younger players being inserted, I think that's exactly what you want to see. Because look, sometimes you don't blame her for doubling down on the veterans at the World Cup. It was something we warned against, but from a coaching perspective, I don't blame her, just because, you know, it's those veterans have been key to her since day one. They've rewarded her faith. But there's also a time, that's the tough time as a coach, knowing when the veterans, you know, might be time to let go and really refresh things. Now she's done that. And if she can build off this and head in the Olympics next year, I think will be a whole different story. So yeah, I think this was a huge camp for Priestman because she had to adjust. And it was always going to be risky, right? Because we have to remember, these are two must-win games. One was on the road in Jamaica on a tough field. It could have easily backfired against her. And all of a sudden, yeah, maybe you look better tactically, but then you make a few mistakes and you lose and you're out of an Olympics. So your next major tournament, you know, the World Cup will be in 27. So I think, you know, she did the right gamble. It paid off. And if they can build off this, I like what this team could become, because it feels like for the first time in a while, like probably even before Kenneth Heiner-Muller, like this was a camp where Canada looked like a modern, fluid, front-facing team. And after so many years of being like, oh, can Canada keep up at the modern level? Can they do so without defending and sitting deep? And for the first time in this camp, it feels like they started to look like a team that could answer those questions long term.
And from Michael, as well as from InfoKid, is this it for Sinclair, or is she able to stick around long enough for the 2024 Olympics as her last hurrah? And from InfoKid, should Sinky 12 retire? And I think she should play a few of the preparation friendlies for the World Cup. I would think that, or for the Olympics, I would think that they're going to have a few, just considering how sort of adamant they've been about scheduling friendlies. But I think maybe play Gold Cup, because that's going to be no doubt a larger roster, and that be your last hurrah, and then maybe one friendly or something at home that is a bit of a send off match, because I don't think she's necessarily good enough to go to the Olympics anymore.
What I would do is, look, I do think that she is done, not right now, but before the Olympics come around, I think she'll play her last game for the national team. What I think will end up happening is she'll get the opportunities to play in the friendlies. She'll maybe get one final home send-off just before the Olympics, because maybe they'll do like a home send-off before they travel to Paris. That'll be her last game. And then the rest of the squad goes on, because look, I understand wanting to bring her for the veteran leadership. She's obviously going to be very selfless. We saw it in this window. You want to have someone like that in the room. She's still a very intelligent player and a lethal scorer when she gets in position, but against the very elite, even coming off the bench for 15, 20 minutes,
but
I don't know if she has it anymore.
Like, is she even a lethal scorer when she gets in position? She got in position last night. She was in position at the World
Cup.
That's
true.
And she wasn't lethal in those.
Look, she could play in the midfield. She could play in that free role as part of the front three, where she isn't one of like the front two in the 1-1 split. She kind of has that freedom to sort of roam, and she's the one maybe unlocking space. But really, what's the point? You have so many young attackers coming through. You have so much depth, and you have a bunch of prospects coming out of the NCAA as well. You have to eventually move on. I know it's tough to do it, and you're in a very sticky situation with the legend, but I think either way, she's never been the kind of person who has wanted the spotlight on her. So I think if you have those conversations with her and you come to an agreement of stick around for the next few months, we'll give you a send-off at home before we go off to the Olympics, and then from there, that might be it. I think she would welcome that, to be honest.
And I think that's probably the best option for the national team as well, because even when you bring up, you say, veteran leadership, does this group need it?
No, still have it.
Does Jordan Heidemann and Julia Grosso even need veteran leadership at this point? They both have over 60 caps.
And if Janine Becky comes back, that's another veteran leader to bring in, right? So like, it's not like you're lacking in it. It's just you have that aura of the legend that can be tough to move on. But eventually you do have to, and I hate to say it this way, but rip off the Band-Aid and say, all right, look, we love what you've done. Thank you for all your years of service. This is nothing personal, but the time has come. And she's probably feeling that too. She definitely knows the time is near. It's just a case of when is the right time. And I think that's the right time.
Well, we'll see. Because I mean, look, like for Sinclair, the only thing that's like, you know, the tough part is that, look, she's still performing at club level though. Like she's still every week on one of the best, if not the best team in the NWSL. She's playing 60s. She's, you know, combining nicely with her, you know, with younger teammates, and she still plays a huge role on the Thorns. Where because of that, I do think she still provides value. And I think in terms of next year, does she make an 18 at the Olympics? No, I don't think so. I think there's just too many, like if especially if it's an 18, there's going to be way too much. Like you need versatility. You're going to need your Janine Beckys, your Ashley Lawrences, you know, you're going to need those options in midfield, your Fleming, Quinn, Grossos. You know, you're not going to leave out Buchanan, Gill, Jade Rose probably makes it. All of a sudden, like there already, those are just defenders and midfielders, and you're not even getting to the attackers. And so I don't think Sinclair makes an 18 at the next Olympics. Maybe if it expands to 23, she has a shot as a super sub. But I'd say really the only thing that would point me more to her retirement is I don't know if she'll be playing in the NWSL last year, because it did take a while for her to make the decision to return this year. They won the title. She obviously made the decision during the celebration that she'd be back for one more year. I do wonder if by the end of the year, the Thorns push for another title and that's it for Sinclair. And then in that case, it's just kind of, you know, she kind of makes a decision herself. For now, I think there's too much time between now and next year. Because personally, if she's somehow still playing with the Portland Thorns next year, still putting up 60s, you'd have to put her in the mix as a sub option for Canada. Because I think for my money, she's looked good as a sub option. It's just as we saw at the World Cup, the starting days is just, it's just too much. It's, you know, but off the bench, even yesterday, okay, she missed a few chances. She still got the brain. She still got the ability to combine and bring something a bit off the bench. But anything other than that with the national team, it's too much to ask. So I think we'll see how the end of the year goes. I personally think she retires by the end of the year anyways, and it's not even a discussion you have next year. Maybe hopefully the discussion you can have is, look, Christine, obviously you might want to figure out what you're doing professionally. If you'd want to be part of the staff, maybe that could be a useful addition to get that veteran addition in, maybe for the Olympics, even like maybe she isn't part of the staff for the year, but then shows up for the Olympics and kind of serves as a mentor there. But we'll see what happens at the end of the year, because I think she has obviously a big, you know, end of the season ahead with the Thorns. Like the Thorns legit looked really good. And hopefully, you know, for them, Sophia Smith's injury isn't too serious. Cause if it isn't, I think they can go win another title. And maybe if they do that, it might be the end anyway for Sinclair. And if that's the case, it'll line up perfectly that maybe in November you do a send-off game and it all lines up and it's a good way to go out. But we'll see, because I don't know. I thought she did well in her super sub cameo yesterday, even if she didn't score, but it's also something where, like you mentioned, there are so many options up front that if she is getting in the way of them and if she is struggling, then yes, it is going to lead to a tough discussion before next year, which, I mean, we'll see if she's even around to have that discussion anyways.
And from Oz Sweeney, who's your pick to get into the Olympic squad that wasn't on the roster for this window? And I think it has to be Janine Becky as kind of the freebie call, just because she would be in this team if she wasn't injured. She was around the team even with her injury. But other than that, I mean, it's pretty wide open.
Yeah, I think outside of the obvious names, like a Becky, maybe even an Alicia Chapman, now that they've gone to a center back, back three, and she can clearly fill in one of those roles as well, maybe on the left side. She can also play fullback, but I think in that system, she'd probably be more center back option. Zoe Burns is one name, potentially. Sarah Stratigakis, if her form continues, you can maybe bring in one of them as a additional option for the midfield. Other than that, like, I do notice, because I was looking at this the other day, there are a lot of really good center back prospects in the NCAA right now. So I wonder if Priestman ends up giving a chance to a couple of them over the next few months leading into the Olympics, and we end up maybe seeing one of them given some time, because with the amount of decent players that there are at that level, and we've seen her, she's been willing to give those players an opportunity, even just the experience, even if it's just to come in and train and be a sparring partner, that could also be an option too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, amongst those who missed out, of course, can't forget Deanne Rose either, Jade Revere. Those two should be in the mix once healthy. Other than that, I mean, Clarissa Larcy up front, you know, especially with Hacken. She was obviously injured with Hacken, and they're, you know, they're about to be in the, or I don't know if, I think they're still in the Champions League, if I'm not mistaken. I'll double check on that. But Clarissa Larcy up front has continued to look like an intriguing option. Other than that, it's going to have to be a wild card, like you mentioned, someone maybe in the NCAA who pops off. Maybe it's someone who Amanda Allen, maybe next year. She just took this first year as a pro, comes out flying next year with Orlando. She could be an option. But I think other than that, yeah, it's going to have to be a big surprise, because I think if you look at this group that was called in for this camp, it's a good mix of, like, you're looking at it, that's a lot of them are in their prime, right? Like, Kadisha Buchanan's still 27. Lawrence is 28. Gilles, 27. Carl, 24. Jade Rose, 20. You know, Riviere's still just 22. Quinn, 28. Grosso, 23. Someone like Aladu, 28, Fleming, 25, Awuzo, 20, Hoidema, 22. Like, you go down, like, there's barely anyone. Basically, the only ones over 30 at the World Cup were Schmidt, Scott, Sinclair, you know, Zdorsky, Leon. I mean, Schmidt's retired. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Scott, especially with these midfield options stepping up. It feels like Quinn's really stepped up to replace what Scott has brought. So, yeah, I think this is a young, you know, still a young team. So I don't think we've seen that much of a surprise unless someone like an Allen just, you know, comes out and is playing 90s in the NWSL, putting up good chance creation metrics or something like that.
And from Dan Clark at Dan Clark 999, does Bev stick with the team or pull a John Herdman?
I think she sticks around at least until the Olympics, especially now that the Federation's committed to providing those resources that the women's national team needs. So that would have been really the number one reason why she would leave and quote unquote pull a Herdman. But the fact that that's been guaranteed, unless the promise is broken, I think she is going to stick around for the foreseeable future now, especially now that the team seems to be reinvigorated.
I don't think she leaves by her own, you know, choice, say, but I do wonder if the, depending on how the U.S. fills their vacant head coaching position, like if they make an aggressive push to take someone like Priestman, if it might be too much for Canada to handle, like, say, financially, because the U.S. will obviously be able to throw something financially at her. But I think other than that, she stays. And especially now that she's made the Olympics, the pressure is off. And if she wants to stay and she, you know, there's no interest, doesn't get too high, I'd see her at least for the Olympics next year and then see from there.
And getting into our Canadian Premier League recap, Vancouver defeated Valor 1-0 last Wednesday. Calgary downed York United and then found out that they had won the title for the regular season on the plane as Forge beat Pacific 3-1. Vancouver also beat the HFX Wanderers 2-1 and Valor downed Atletico Ottawa 1-0. Calgary win the CPL Shield and qualify for the 2024 Champions Cup, a chance to face potentially Lionel Messi at Spruce Meadows. Forge and Pacific clinch playoff spots alongside Calgary, and Halifax is nearly there, while Ottawa and York battle for fifth. So the top of the table, completely settled. The bottom of the table, completely settled, but it's that middle. Yep. That two playoff spots remaining, three teams, and Atletico versus York coming up this weekend, and that's certain to be an exciting one. But just your initial thoughts on Calgary winning the league, and then Ottawa or York to get through.
Credit to Calgary, because they've been one of the most consistent teams in the CPL since their formation alongside Forge. They just haven't had a trophy to show for it. And you know, especially when you look at how they started the year, they kept drawing games that they were dominating in. They just couldn't get the finishing. They had bad finishing luck the other way in terms of teams just finding a late equalizer out of nowhere off a set piece, and then they had to settle for a point. And people were asking us early in the season if Wealdon might be in trouble or if he might step down. And we kind of thought, listen, patience here. They've shown a propensity for being able to kind of end up cakewalking their way into the top two or top three in the league every single year. They'll be fine. What's funny is that they were underachieving their expected goals in the first like 6-8 games of the season, and now they're overachieving it to finish the season here. I think there's something like third or fourth in pretty much every category, which is kind of crazy because Forge and Pacific are still top two, but then you have Cavalry and I believe it's HFX sort of in that 3-4 spot. But look, Meyer Bevan's been firing in goals. We know the brilliance of Ali Moussi. Shamit Shome has been excellent as that hybrid wingback, sort of inverted wingback, whatever you want to call him. And it's been the culmination, I think, of what's been an amazing decade plus for Tommy Wealdon and just overall what he has done in the Calgary area. Because not only has he built a winning club, a strong culture, he's exporting players to other leagues. Just look at all the names that have come through the club and who are now thriving elsewhere while still being consistent on the pitch. The only thing that was lacking was the trophy recognition. He's got that now, and it's been a long time coming. So I'm thrilled for him, and I'm very happy for Cavalry as well, because the work that Foothills and Cavalry have done over the last 10-15 years is nothing short of extraordinary.
Well, that's the most remarkable part, isn't it? Like the fact that if you look across the four full CPL seasons that have been played, sorry to the island games, as fun as it was to watch, you know, the shortened tournament, like Cavalry's finished first in three of them. Like they've tied for, they finished first in the first year. They tied for first in 2021. Forge was ahead on goal difference, but hey, you tie for first, it's pretty much first, right? And then this year you finish first. Like that's impressive, especially like you mentioned, they're doing so well, not sacrificing development. You're sending your Joel Watermans, your Victor Latouris, your Arabin Pepples, your Gauthier Tignes. You're sending all those guys on to the next level, but you're also developing other talent. So I think that's the most impressive part for Cavalry. What's impressive this year too is that this really felt like a refresh year. I think heading into it, when I was doing my previews on each team, I wrote for Cavalry, one of the things was like, how are they going to handle so much rotation? Because throughout the first 4 years, or so much turnover, sorry, in the first 4 years, they'd had such a core group of guys. Like you can think back and remember the guys like Jay Wealdon, you know, Nick Ledgerwood, you know, guys even like Elijah Adekugbe, who had been there since day one. And this year, they'd only had two originals left in their team, in Marco Carducci and Sergio Camargo. Yet this Cavalry team looks like what Cavalry wants to be. They had that identity, but they added a bit of fluidity tactically. So I think credit has to be given to Tommy Wealdon Jr. for getting that out of his team, for not budging to adversity. And I mean, we'll see how they can do now in the playoffs, because the playoffs has been where they've often come up short. There's no doubting their regular season dominance. I mean, I mentioned it off the top how good they've been. So hopefully these playoffs can be a chance for them to prove that they can also get those demons behind them, get a double, because I credit to what Cavalry has been able to put together.
And coming up on Sunday, Ottawa against York, basically battling for a playoff spot. I'm going to be spending pretty much all day at York Lion Stadium, because I'll go out for the York United match at 1 o'clock. And then there's York Lions women at 6 o'clock, which I'm broadcasting, as well as York Lions men at 8:15. So it's going to be a long day at York Lion Stadium for me.
Good luck to you, because that is...
Miserations.
Because that's maybe not the most entertaining area either to be in as well.
There's a little mall there.
Oh, there you go. That's decent. Look, I said it at the beginning of the season when we were doing our previews that York would miss out. I've stuck by that recently. I'm going to continue sticking by it, because they're not good defensively, simply put. Like I think they're second from bottom in terms of shots conceded and expected goals conceded, only to Vancouver. And Vancouver's picked it up in the last few games. So it's actually kind of trending downward for York. It's trending upward for Vancouver. They could find themselves at the bottom of both by the time the season's over. And offensively, they're near the bottom as well, although it's worth noting Ottawa is overachieving their numbers, but it's what they do. Like they've done that since Carlos Gonzalez became the coach. And look, typically when you show a repeated trend of being able to do that, that's just who you are, and that's what you're going to get. And Ottawa defensively has improved a lot since Nate Ingham came back. So I'm going to favor them. York's home form is absolutely dreadful. Ottawa should be able to get the job done and pretty much put a stranglehold on that last playoff spot for me.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably the logical answer. I am curious to see about York, though, because they've been such a streaky team, and it feels like they're kind of due for a bit of a, just because they've had three tough, borderline embarrassing home losses in a row. No way they get a fourth to end it, but also because also Ottawa's like, this is just two teams in terrible form. So I'm just kind of, I mean, I'm intrigued to see who can kind of get out of the slump, because yeah, York's, their splits are so weird this year because they're really good offensively on the road. They struggle defensively both home and away, but then on the road, they kind of outscore some of the problems, which is hilarious. Cause I think like 90% of sports teams, it's always the opposite. Like, yeah, okay, maybe at home you'll be better offensively, but on the road you struggle to score. Nah, York, for whatever reason, can't score at home. And it's led to their struggles, but I still do think York has some juice left in them, especially given they play Vancouver away last week while Forge plays, or Otto plays Forge away last week. If York can edge out a draw or even, you know, a win or something like that, they'd set themselves up nicely for the last week. But yeah, because if they have to win this weekend, so I expect York to come out, because if they don't after three straight, then my goodness. So, I mean, if Peter's going to go Ottawa, I'll stick with York, just because I also had them in my top five since the beginning of the year, just because talent-wise, this should be a top five team. And we'll see if they can prove it against Ottawa and then against Vancouver.
And from Michael, what does Valor need to do this winter to help finally reach the playoffs next year? I think you need a whole lot of changes there because, I mean, you go 5 years in the CPL, it's not a difficult league to make the playoffs in, considering the size of the league and the size of the league that it once was before a bit of expansion. You should be making the playoffs once every 2 years.
I don't think they're that bad, though. That's the thing. I think their biggest problem is just the lack of a talisman or someone who can just regularly pot goals. I know that sounds so simple to say, but if you look at the Golden Boot race and even just overall combined goals and assists, pretty much all the top four or five teams in the league have one, if not multiple players with double digits. Forge definitely does. I believe Pacific does as well. And you look at Valor's top scorers, it's Keon Williams and Diego Gutierrez with four goals each. Now, Williams also has five assists, so it goes to show you he's kind of getting it done in both areas, but you need a number nine who can actually regularly pot the goals in. Chance creation isn't a problem. Even defensively, not that big of a problem. I know they dealt with the string of injuries earlier in the season, which probably didn't help, but I think if they can get that number nine in, they could very easily be a playoff team, I think. Because they're right there with York in terms of chance creation. They just lack the attacking options who can consistently put goals away. They could actually be in a position York is in right now in terms of being on the bubble for the playoffs. But because of that, they're not. So I think the solution is fairly simple for me.
I think for solution, yeah, it's revitalize the attack. Because I think you look at this Valor team, pound for pound, they might have the best midfield in the league. Like, you just look at that, like, even just their main four options, right? It's Diego Gutierrez, who's been excellent this year. You got Marcello Polisi. You've got Dante Campbell, who might be one of the signings of the season. And then you got, you know, someone like Juan Pablo Sanchez. They're set in midfield. Okay. Then you go at the, you know, in goal, you have Ryan Yesley, who's, you know, he's dipped a bit lately, but he's still one of the best keepers in the league. Statistically, he's still been the best keeper in the league across the year. You look at the back line, they've got options. They've been good defensively for the most part, even despite the fact that Andrew Jean-Baptiste, one of the best CBs in the league, has been injured for most of the year again. They've had some good options step up. It's really all in the attack, like you mentioned, Peter, a lack of goal scorers. And it just has to be frustrating if you're a Valor fan, because they did so well to beef up their midfield, beef up the back. Yet heading into the year, the big storyline was, who's going to score the goals? Because what happened last year is Moses Dyer and Sean Rea set the assist record. Moses Dyer was your team's leading goal scorer. They both leave and you don't replace them. You bring in Yongabir and Williams. Yes, but the issue even last year when Rea was dropping assists was having a main number nine up front. So for Valor, it's absolutely just revitalizing that attack, going after someone like an Alejandro Diaz type player like Vancouver went after, because I think that would do a world of difference, because Valor played some very structured, organized football. And I think Phil DeSantos did a great job of, to their credit, like, you'd think a team that's in last, you'd be like, oh, they're struggling, they're sloppy. No, every time I watch Valor, they're cohesive, they're organized, they're in every game. It's just these moments that hurt them. And you know, you need a number nine sometimes to take you through some of those moments, or a main talisman, or a Sean Rea type player like they had last year, and they just didn't have that player last year. And that's why they ended up drawing so many games or losing one goal games that they should have maybe done better in.
And getting into our MLS recap as well, Inter Miami down Toronto FC 4-0 last Wednesday. Also on that match day, CF Montreal battled to a 1-1 draw with FC Cincinnati, and Houston slashed the Vancouver Whitecaps 4-1. On the weekend, Atlanta United beat CF Montreal 4-1. Real Salt Lake defeated Vancouver 2-1 in a weird game, and New York City FC defeated Toronto FC 3-0 after their game was delayed a day due to a burst water pipe. The Whitecaps face Colorado tonight in what is pretty well a must-win for Vancouver.
Yes, it is, and that's their game in hand, so we'll get a better sense of where they stand in the West after the win, because they go up to fourth if they win, and they still have games in hand over some teams, like I believe Seattle, LA, teams like that. So yeah, that'll be an important one, and if they don't win that against a really horrific Colorado team, then you're kind of thinking like, okay, are they still just a little bit heavy-legged and tired, or is there something to watch for here as the final games come?
I mean, what a change a week can make, because last week we spent half an hour talking about...
NFP jinx, let's go!
half an hour talking about the Whitecaps' potential MLS Cup contenders.
To be fair, though, they are tired. Like, and you can see it. Like, I mean, they're traveling back and forth. They've spent the day in Vancouver, flew down to Houston, came back to Vancouver, flew down to Salt Lake. Like, it does wear on you a little bit.
Well, look, I am going to say, for what it's worth, when we did talk about their MLS Cup hopes, I did say this is a team that offensively can go to MLS Cup, but defensively there are worries. They go out and concede six across two games. So, like, it is something where we weren't, at least, I don't know. I think you guys were also in a similar boat where, you know, yes, they have this offensive potential that when they're clicking, they just look so fantastic. But defensively, like the goals they allowed against Houston, the goals they allowed against RSL, it just... You can't be allowing goals like that on the road, especially. Maybe at home you can outscore your problems, but on the road you can't. And that's all. And it was unfortunate because it felt like for a few weeks they'd kind of gotten rid of a bit of that. And then, and all of a sudden heading in these last few games, you're asking questions of the defense. You're asking questions of Yohei Takaoka, which a few months ago you weren't. And I think that could end up being the big storyline heading in these last few games is, can they get any sort of, like, you know, can they keep back-to-back clean sheets? Can they keep a goal or less under for a few games in a row, especially against Western Conference opposition?
And from Oz Sweeney, the Whitecaps have had a good season with some youth finally breaking into the first team and getting good minutes. Who do you think breaks through next, and what has happened with Karifa Yao? He was a promising signing but seems to have struggled a bit this year. Does he just need more time? I'd say the next one to probably break through is Gerson Chiminikov, however you pronounce his name.
He's an effort regardless.
They missed the MLS Next Pro playoffs, but he was solid throughout the season, and certainly one of the bright spots on a team that struggled at a lot of points. I also want to shout out Lowell Wright. I don't think he's anywhere near cracking the first team, but he scored, I think it was a hat trick in the last match, including one shot from like 35 yards that looked like the keeper had stopped it and then somehow bobbled it into his own goal.
I'll throw out a wild card here because... And this is assuming he isn't coming back, but Russell Tybert's contract expires at the end of this season. So that would free up a spot for a midfielder to come in. As we shed a lonely tear here that Russell Tybert's going to be retiring. The king of Vancouver soccer is going to be retiring. Canadian soccer Jesus himself.
York United, sir.
But with him being out of contract, I look at Javon Bodwell potentially being the next one, especially if he has a really good under-17 World Cup in what's going to be a pretty good group, competitive group. He already possesses, I think, a high-level IQ on the pitch. He's super composed on the ball, technically gifted, a defensive stalwart, and we've seen that he has an engine because he was playing 90 minutes every other day at the CONCACAF U17s. And he's also got, five consecutive starts with Whitecaps FC2 to close out the season and looked really good in all of them. So... when you look at someone like Ali Ahmed last year, he was kind of in a similar position where he was getting a string of starts. He looked really good. He comes into the first team picture, still looks very good, and ends up getting a chance, called up to the national team, all that, and now we see how key of a player he is. I think Bodwell could follow a similar path. He's going to be 18 in March. I think he's going to be a part of preseason if he does well at the Under-17 World Cup. might be a part of preseason regardless. And I think he would be someone to really, really watch for. As for Khalifa Yao, look, we're not privy to how he performs in training, how quickly or not quickly he's grasping the tactical platforms that Sartini wants. So that is worth keeping in mind. But when a player who clearly showed that he was ready for the next step last year ends up having not a big shot to build on that this year, it indicates that he might be struggling to adapt tactically to what Sartini wants. Like, coaches go with players they can trust. I think that's why Laborda, for example, wasn't getting a run of starts after he signed in his primary position, or even just in general, whereas Jevane Brown was being played out of position, because he knew tactically what was going to be asked of him, and Laborda probably wasn't at that stage yet. Now, Laborda's getting more starts. He's clearly a lot more comfortable in the system. Sartini's more comfortable using him, and you see that he's now kind of displaced Laborda in the lineup. So I wonder if that's the case with Yao. He's also not the quickest, and given their issues in transition and general lack of pace at center back regardless, that might be one reason not to start him, but he's strong in the air. He can spray a really good diag into a wing back, and we know that Sartini would probably want that. So there are some things to like. I just wonder if he maybe needs a little bit more time to grasp that at this level. Because keep in mind, this is his first proper MLS season outside of the odd stint he had with Montreal before he joined Cavalry.
Yeah, the L one's tough because, like we mentioned, he looked so good last year in the CPL. He looked like someone who could, just make that jump up, especially with his strengths in the air. Like we mentioned, there were some concerns with ball playing and foot speed, but you thought playing in a back three can mask that. But also, like you mentioned, it's the first season in MLS. And I think what could be comforting to him is that a lot of some of the other center backs that have made the jump, it took time. Like Lucas McNaughton, he's been great at Nashville, right? But last year at TFC, he was struggling to get in the squad and struggled when he was in. Joel Waterman, like you mentioned, he only got really opportunities in year one because of all the injuries they had in their Champions League run. And then, he really took until 2021, I think it was, for him to become a regular. It took him almost 2 years. So I think it is also tough for center backs because it's just the opportunity's not there. Like, you don't get that chance to ease in like 5 minutes at a time, 10 minutes at a time, 15 minutes at a time, because you just don't really do that with center backs. If a center back's in, you want to have him go 90. So I do wonder if what they do for him next year, like if they say, okay, maybe get an offseason comeback, be confident. Do you try maybe a loan next year just to kind of jumpstart his confidence and then try again the next year? I'll be curious to see, because I do think it's something where, as a center back who's still, he's what, 22, 23, you saw what he could do in the CPL. I'd like to think he gets a bit of a, maybe a fresh start, especially because it's not new to see center backs maybe take a little time to make that jump up. And part of that's just also the nature of, becoming a center back. It's like becoming a goalkeeper, right? Like, for every Sirois story where he comes in year one and wins the job after an injury, sometimes you never get your chance because your starter just never gives up his job. And that's also the nature of those positions. In terms of the other question, I'd echo some of the shouts put out there. Keep an eye out on Mikhail Gurmismenkov because he's just 19, 20. Fullback. Whitecaps could use some fullback depth, especially if someone like a Martins doesn't come back. So I expect him to, what I expect for a lot of these guys, like as well, a Jeevan Badwal, a few other names as well, at center back, a Finn Linder or a Matteo Campagna. I'd be interested to see them maybe come into training camp, really push. And then from there, maybe they play in some preseason games, then they go back to next pro, and then they're basically the first names called up. And then they kind of go in Ali, because that's kind of the route Ali Ahmed went last year. Like, he was great in preseason, but they didn't give him the first team deal right away. It was a taste. Like, look, you're close. He went and dominated next pro. He got his call ups and then he was signed. And then we saw that this year with Levante Johnson. You get your reps in preseason, you do well, you get your call ups. So I think going through that route with some of those youngsters, Gurmismenkov was already with the first team last year. Campania's been with the first team. I'd like to see them potentially really thrive in a preseason and push to make that sort of jump up.
CF Montreal, winless in 5. Quick thoughts on them.
I think a couple of those games, particularly the Chicago game, they were unlucky not to win. Instead of having 2 points from 5, they probably could have 6 points at least from 5, if not maybe 7 or 8. But recently, and maybe this is just having to do with the quick turnarounds and whatnot, they really have been largely outplayed in a couple of their recent games. That Atlanta game, they were just completely outclassed. And it doesn't get any easier either. I think they play Houston, Portland, Orlando, and there's one other decent team in there as well that the name is escaping me. So this is not going to get any easier. Defensively, they're hemorrhaging chances. Offensively, they're not creating much, which is very curious because they were doing well there. They just didn't have a finisher. They bring in Opoku, who was supposed to solve the problem, and he kind of was in terms of he was getting the chances, just wasn't finishing them. So I just wonder if this is a bit of a rough patch. Well, I guess we'll find out over the next couple of games if this is indeed just the case where they've been a bit unlucky. Maybe the short turnaround exacerbated some problems and they figure it out again. They're good enough to be a playoff team. It's just, can they actually put it consistently together now as we look at the last four games of the season?
Yeah, well, they might make the playoff just because no one in the bottom seven in the East wants to win right now, except Miami. Yeah. And even then, Montreal has a one spot buffer, so they can allow Miami to join them. But yeah, I think it comes down to goals. I think the biggest thing is I'm looking across their last 14 games against MLS opposition. So there's some Leagues Cup games in this. They've scored more than two or more goals three times, and they've scored more than three or more goals once. And it was against TFC, and TFC's got pretty much one of the worst defensive records in the league. And yeah, there's only two teams in the league that have scored fewer than Montreal this year: TFC, Colorado. Those are not, that's not company you want to be in with offensively. Because look, I think Montreal has what it takes defensively to make the playoffs, especially after, as we've seen in midseason, once they kind of got a bit of stability, Jonathan Sirois really found his feet. You know, they've got options at the back. It's just like, yeah, like Peter mentioned, it's who the heck's going to score. Romel Kyoto's been out injured all year. Maybe he can come back and solve some of that. You know, Opoku's been an intriguing option up front, but he's not the main guy. Vilsain's looked great, but he's young. He's unpolished. He's not going to be the, you know, maybe next year with these minutes, he can really step up. But then you're looking at guys like Chinoso on four. This guy just, I don't know if he could, he couldn't score if his life depended on it right now. Sanusi Ibrahim can score, but he just can't get any consistency and, you know, really get the starting minutes. There's just, you know, there's too many question marks up front, and that's going to be, if I don't know if they'll be able to solve that by the end of the year. So I think they make it in the playoffs based on their defense. They'll probably scrape out some more 1-0 wins, but they're not scoring enough goals. And you look at it, that's they're drawing 1-1s, 0-0s. And at this time of the season, you need to be turning those 1-1s into 2-1s. You need to be turning those 0-0s into 1-0s, and they haven't been able to do that.
And before we move on from our MLS section, just quick thoughts on the Seattle Sounders rebrand. I like it.
I don't mind it at all. Some people were just like, oh, it's too minimalist and it's too simple. Like, I think it's right to the point. You know exactly what's on their crest in terms of it's the Space Needle. It's a Seattle symbol. It's clean. It's sleek. I quite like it personally.
The funniest thing I saw was a slightly adjusted version with the CN Tower, and it was TFC's rebrand.
Oh my gosh. That would actually be so MLS if then TFC decided to come up with a CN Tower one, and then Vancouver does the same thing with their kind of
fucking Harbor Center.
One, you know?
Harbor,
yeah,
Center.
Just imagine like every team in the league just with their pointy statue in their city just ends up putting that in their crest. It's like, hey, MLS has similar kits. Why not similar logos?
Oh my god.
Yeah, I don't know how the DC United, the Washington Monument would look on a kit. That might be a bit anyways you know what, in terms of the rebrand, I think did they need the rebrand? No. Does it look fine? Yeah. And I think it's been one of the better rebrands, because for whatever reason, you look at the Chicago Fire, you look at CF Montreal's original rebrand, you look at the Columbus Crew, they've just gone too far away from what was great about the original logo. So I think it's good that Seattle kept their identity. Some teams rebrand all the time, but I think the issue is if you rebrand away from your core identity. Like, that's why Montreal, they moved away. People like, no, you got to get the Thrill de Lis back. You got to get the Blue and Black back. And they're like, okay, yeah, you're right. And they did so. So credit to Seattle for sticking with that.
And I guess Seattle's not the only one to use a physical landmark is their crest, because St. Louis exists and they have the St. Louis Arch in there. But MLS crest, certainly an intriguing discussion. But getting into our Canucks Abroad recap and mailbag, the Northern Football Podcast is proudly partnered with Canucks Abroad. Find the full Canadian player pool and daily schedules for Canadians in action at canucks-abroad.ca. Alphonso Davies had another assist, his fourth of the season, in Byron's 7-0 win over Bochum. He also started in the cup win over Munster. Stefan Eustáquio scored for Porto and locked down the midfield in their 2-1 win over Gil Vicente. Steven Vitoria stayed in the lineup for Chavez in their 2-2 draw with Amadora. That's the first time he's picked up consecutive starts this season. Ismael Kone had a man of the match display for Watford in their 2-2 draw with West Brom in midweek action last week. He started the weekend match against Leeds as well. It was Jaden Nelson against Kosi Thompson in Norway, with Thompson's Lillestrøm winning 3-0 over Nelson's Rosenborg. Nelson was sent off in the 66th minute, while Thompson was a late sub for Lillestrøm. Maxim Crepo picked up his third straight start for LAFC and a second clean sheet in their 0-0 draw with Philadelphia. And just here for sports news, at Here for Sports News, projected men's national team roster for the Japan friendly, and I would guess that Maxim Crepo gets himself back in the fold.
Yeah, it's going to be a good little, like, there's some interesting little battles, I think. I think in goal, I'd see a trio maybe of Crepo, Sirwa, St. Clair. Let those guys duke it out. I mean, it's hard to see if Borjan will be back. He's kind of struggled a bit at times to start the year with Slovan Bratislava, especially with Crepo back. Let him get integrated. We'll see on that. It's definitely going to come down to those four. I guess you could also throw Tom McGill into that mix as well. I'd personally just like to see Sirwa, St. Clair, and Crepo just to get a read, especially on how they've been doing at the back. Finally, hopefully Cornelius can make it back in after missing out on the few with injury. Kamal Miller will probably be in there. I'd like to see Lucas McNaughton push in based off his Nashville form. Maybe Joel Waterman. Hard to tell with Steven Vitoria because he's finally getting minutes again, but he also really struggled to start the year, so I don't know. He might be the odd man out because we really don't know if Mauro Biello is really going to, you know, turn over the team like that. I do think fullback should be pretty straightforward. You got Johnston, Larea, you got Adekugbe. Likely you'll count Davies in that group. And then in midfield, give me some Chouanier, give me some Ahmed, then Kone, Eustáquio. I think probably a veteran like an Azorio sticks around. Might be just a bit too tight number wise for like a Latoury to slot in. Otherwise, and then you move up front. I think hopefully I'm not missing any names along the way there. Certainly a lot of options. And then up front, I think it's going to be David Larin Ugbo, although Larin's form is a big worry right now for Mallorca. He missed a huge chance against Barcelona and he just does not look up to full speed right now, which, you know, it's a bit of a worry because of course sometimes you start the year slow, but to come in, have your coach say that you're unfit and to see him struggling the way he is, we'll see. Maybe sometimes with Larin, he just needs a camp with Canada to get his form back. But then, yeah, I think Ugbo gets in. He slowed down a bit lately with Cardiff, but he had a good start to the year. And then from there, Tejan Buchanan, if healthy, gets in. If not, it will open up the door for some others. I think otherwise, probably a Liam Miller sneaks in, a Theo Corbianu as well as wide players to complete things. And lastly, maybe some options like a Nathan Saliba could be looked at. He's really gotten some good consistency in his game as of late for Montreal. He's looked so much more confident right now. You wonder maybe someone like Mauro Biello, he follows Montreal closely, especially that academy. I wonder if someone like a Saliba could make sense. Otherwise, I'm just curious to see what kind of veterans get called in. I didn't put many here. I don't know if there will be maybe like a Sam Piet slots in it, especially at the six in lieu of a Latoury. So watch for that. Of course, Azorio, like I mentioned. Other than that, yeah, maybe Steven Vitoria or a Milan Boyan, but I doubt it based on form. So, yeah, it could be a bit of a younger refresh lineup, which would be curious to see how they do in Japan and if they can use that as a building block to head into, you know, the Copa America qualifiers in November with the last few months put behind them.
And that's all we've got for episode 141 of the Northern Football Podcast, a full wrap of Canadian soccer, including Canada back to the Olympics in women's soccer, and back to the stage where they can try to defend their gold medal next summer in Paris. Certainly an exciting time for the women's national team, a breath of fresh air in this window, and a successful one as well. For Alex Gungi-Ruzic and Peter Galindo, I've been Ben Steiner. Thanks so much for listening to Northern Football. We'll be back next week.